to read Back to Reality, the best-selling novel of the Bestseller Experiment by the two Marks, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/back to reality.
And subscribe to this podcast to get loads of extra bonuses. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com/subscribe. Let's run the show. Hello and welcome to the Christmas Bestseller Experiment, where we continue to discover what makes a best-selling novel and inspire you to finish your book. I'm Mark DeVoe.
Ho, 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 and I'm Mark Stay. Oh, dear. Yes, I'm Mark Stay, and was fired today from my role as store Santa for coughing all over the kids. Welcome to this week's episode. Before we leap into this festive special, a big shout out to our wonderful sponsors at Scrivener. Scrivener is the official writing app of the Bestseller Experiment, and it can be yours, dear listener, for a chunky 20% off. Just pop over to literatureandlatte.com, put in the code BestsellerXP when prompted, and you will receive that significant discount on what is, frankly, the bestest gift that you can give yourself this Christmas. If you've got writing ambitions for now or next year, get yourself some Scrivener.
Marvellous stuff. Merry Christmas, Mr. Stay.
And season's greetings to you, Mr. DeVoe. How are you this year?
I'm doing great. This Christmas Eve is it's a very special time because I grew up with a German mother. So Christmas Eve was like the big day. We used to open our presents well before midnight on Christmas Eve. And my friend would always be... really could never understand why Santa always came to my house first. I was like a very privileged child. We go to midnight mass and I'll be telling all my friends about what I'd got for Christmas. And they're like, what? You're in the morning. So I love Christmas Eve. It always has a very special place in my heart. And I'd just like to wish all our listeners a very happy Christmas as well. Mm. It's a very special time of year.
It is indeed.
What are you going to be doing this Christmas? Do you do big family
events?
Yeah,
they all generally come to us. Since we moved, we've got this big sort of open plan area where we can put out the trestle tables and we can get... Well, last year we had 17 of us around a table.
Oh
yeah, this year it's a mere 14.
Yeah, but it's... Three of them died after last year's Christmas meal.
How very dare you,
I shouldn't joke about that, should I? Goodness me.
That's
in mouth.
That's my good lady wife's cooking you're talking about there. Well, one of them has... my nephew and his wife, they have a little baby and they're going to see her parents this year, as is the way of things.
Oh, so lovely. Anyone that even thinks about attempting to make a Christmas meal for 17 people is already on like superstar status in my book. I can barely cook for three kids right now.
For Claire, Christmas starts when they start repeating Delia's Christmas specials on whatever it is, BBC Food or whatever the program she watches it, what channel she watches it on. So she sits there and it's Delia is the thing, Delia Smith, who I don't think is that well known outside the UK, but it's a big tradition over here. So looking forward to it.
Only known to expat Norwich fans, apparently, outside of the UK, but she's the chair lady, I believe. But let me ask you a question. I know around Christmas time, it's a big tradition we have in the house, which I absolutely love, is we always clear off one of the tables that's usually completely stacked with rubbish for the rest of the year. We clear it off and we get a massive Christmas puzzle out and we sit there and I get completely addicted to doing 1,000-piece Christmas puzzles. But in your household, when you get the family around, do you have like a tradition of, say, doing board games or something like that?
Games, board games, card games. Cards Against Humanity is a favourite.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because that was a bit of a leading question because I remember last year you posting something either to me or on your Facebook about playing Cards Against Humanity with your gran and a 14-year-old.
It's absolute filth. It really is.
It's
a bonding experience.
It's very, very funny. Very, very funny.
And every year, my mother-in-law learns new expressions that she can take back to Spain with her.
I played Cards Against Humanity once, and I've got to say, probably most of the time, we were having to search things on Google, and the sites that came up were somewhat... dodgy. But I haven't laughed so much. In fact, I think that's probably the most I've laughed in my life.
Oh, man, it's fantastic. We actually did it. You know, I went on this retreat earlier in the year. We the authors and I, it was a good, again, a very good bonding experience. Once we'd got to know each other after a few days, once we were all kind of relaxed, we could finally play Cards Against Humanity. And it was, Marcus Sedgwick's first time, I think, and it was a real eye opener for him. So.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that's fantastic. Anyway, today we have an incredible Christmas special for you. It is the season of giving, and I'd say we pretty much pulled out all the stops, haven't we, Mr. Stay, for this one?
Oh, I'm just overjoyed to have had the privilege to speak to the wonderful Mr. Ian Rankin. Ian Rankin was born in the Kingdom of Fife, went to the University of Edinburgh. He is a Scottish institution and a major best-selling author and a keystone of Orion Publishing. He was one of the first authors they signed up, and he's still with them now. And he's had this incredible career, which, as you'll hear as we talk to him, you know, started with real uncertainty if he would even have a career. And yet his latest book, In a House of Lies, which is the latest Rebus thriller, his character, John Rebus, went straight to number one as a Sunday Times bestseller, spent 2 weeks at number one at the busiest time of year. He's now enjoying his 11th week in the top 10. He went to number one in the ebooks chart. He's had 10 weeks in the Waterstones top 10. It's his best book ever, way up on the previous book as well. So he's just having the best time of his career ever. And I was just talking to him just after he'd finished his UK tour. He was about to go on a tour of Canada, in fact. So that was great fun. And we had a really good chat. Now, we answer a listener question. We talk about how he plots his novels. We talk about tips on research, short stories, pseudonyms, because he did write under a pseudonym for a while. He talks about his favourite mistake, which he decided to keep in the book. And he talks about his worst habit when writing. And then he tells us his Sean Connery story, which is worth the price of admission alone. This is a real treat.
Absolutely. Absolutely brilliant. And very massively inspiring. So for all the writers out there that think, oh, it's never going to happen, you need to listen to this interview, because there is some stuff you will take away from this that will get you fired up for 2019. And, you know, that's what this podcast is all about. We want you to hear the stories of all these amazing million-selling authors and realize that they were once where we all are now, all, you know, looking for that big opportunity, that big break. So, you know, do take notes, absolutely, because this is an absolutely brilliant interview. Without trying to build it up too much, we need to also tell everyone that after the interview, we have an incredible Ian Rankin competition that you're going to want to listen out for. Mm-hmm. So make sure you don't miss that. And on top of that, we're going to talk a bit about covers, because Ian brings up an interesting, very interesting point about covers. And with our Demonza tie-in right now, that people can get their 10% off demonza.com with Bestseller XP, it's a beautiful tie-in to see how actually one of his biggest breakthroughs was changes in book covers. So let's dive in, Mr. Stay, and listen to Mark chatting with none other than the amazing Ian Rankin.
Mr. Ian Rankin, welcome to the Bestseller Experiment. How are you today, sir?
Tired but happy.
End of a long tour.
Well, it's not the end of a long tour. How dare you, sir? This is the last day of the UK portion of the tour. I get the weekend off, and then I'm flying to Canada on Monday, and I do a Canadian tour. But then when I come back, I've got more stuff in the UK. And then I've got the States, January, February, and on it goes. And writing the books is the easy part, folks.
That's a big tour. You must be like, you know, Dylan, you know, just the never-ending tour.
It can feel like that, but in fact, I only do a book every 2 years now. I've got lazy. I used to do two books a year when I was skint, and now I'm not skint, so I only do one book every 2 years. Plus, the ideas don't come as felicitously as once they did. So I spend a lot more time on the road and marketing myself and the books than I do actually writing them.
Well, huge congratulations in the first place. So your new Rebus thriller, In a House of Lies, number one bestseller for 2 weeks on the trot now, hopefully a third in the bag. And also, this was a fairly new chart that the bookseller are doing, number one in the ebooks chart as well. So congratulations.
Yeah, thanks very much. And I mean, ebooks are a mystery to me. I've got a Kindle, but I don't use it very much. In fact, I almost never use it. I still prefer physical books. And it's interesting, I think people do seem to be coming back to physical books. But having said that, ebooks is a good-sized market, and no writer of any stripe can afford to ignore it.
Absolutely. I've got a listener question, and then we're going to play a game I call Backlist Bingo, and hopefully we'll take a trip through memory lane with you. Our listener is Richie Yanikowitz. What's it like living with Rebus in your head?
Difficult sometimes. I mean, when I invented this character, when I started the series, I had no idea it was a series or that he would stick around, certainly not for as long as he did. I mean, he retired the first time round and I thought I was done with him. Then he insisted on coming back. His worldview is not my worldview. I've always got to be very cautious and careful that it's his way of looking at the world, not mine. His perspective, his philosophy of life, not mine. His musical taste, not necessarily mine, although they are similar in many ways. But I get to say a lot that Ian Rankin doesn't get to say. So I can say a lot through him. I can be the maverick that I'm not allowed to be in real life, or I don't want to be in real life. I don't like getting into confrontations in my life, but he loves it, or he certainly used to love it in the early days. He also mirrors things that are happening in my life. So as he gets older and I'm getting older, we are dealing with the aches and pains and stresses and strains. And also that thing about, you know, you get to the top of your game and then there's always, you're always waiting for the something to knock you back down again, you know. So he's no longer a cop, he's now retired, and I'm thinking, well, will the next book be as good as a book before? Will the next book sell as well as a book before? Are readers getting tired of my voice and his voice? And so being number one after 20 odd books is a complete thrill.
Yeah, it never gets old. Richie has a follow-up question. He says, how do you go about outlining a procedural crime thriller? Are you a big outliner, or do you tend to just jump in?
I mean, I've interviewed quite a few writers down the years, especially crime writers, and I would have to say everybody's different. But more of us than you might imagine make it up as we go along. I don't do a lot of planning. I mean, with this new book, there was something in Private Eye magazine, and it was a story. It was a guy that had been murdered many years before, never solved, and he was a private detective. He was looking at alleged links between senior police officers and organized crime. I thought, well, that's not a bad starting point for a story. It's quite an intriguing starting point for a story. And that was all I had. And so when I started writing the book, I didn't know. I mean, I had, okay, spoiler alert, I had a dead private eye found in the back of his car. But I didn't know who killed him or why. So the first draft of the book, which is written very quickly, is me knowing as little as the detectives at the beginning. And as their investigation proceeds, so does mine. And somewhere along that line, usually two-thirds of the way through the first draft, I work out who it was.
Have you always worked like that?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there was one book that I plotted in so much detail that I didn't need to write the book. I thought, I know how this ends. Why would I need to write it? So if I knew how the book was going to end, I wouldn't need to write the book. I mean, some books have had more plotting than others. I think Black and Blue, which was the first of the big Rebus novels, I did a lot of research before I started writing that book, and it took a long time to write. These days, my research schedule has changed, and I now realise that you can waste a lot of time doing research. You can do far too much. And having done that research, you then feel the need to tell readers you've done it. So you put it all into the book, and that slows the story down. I now do the research after the first draft. Mm-hmm. So between first draft and second draft, I go off and do and find out what I need to know. Because by then, I know, what do I need to know? Not what I might need to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Great stuff. I want to play a game with you that we call Backlist Bingo, where we take a trip down memory lane with you and maybe get some insight into your writing process. So can you pick a number between 1 and 10?
A number between 1 and 10. Okay, let's go for 10.
10, okay. Right, the beat goes on. The complete Rebus stories, short stories. Do they come easily to you? Do they ever inspire longer works? Why do you jump into short stories?
Well, I began life as a short story writer. I mean, if it depends how far back you want to go. If you want to go far enough back, I started. I really started off reading comics and loved comics: the Victor, the Beano, the Hotspur, the Dandy. But I was an obsessive kid, so I then tried to write comics. I would get bits of paper and fold them in half to make little four-page comics, and I would break them up into squares and put little stick people in them and put free gifts on the front, you know, to try and bring in. And I would have one copy of each. It was just hand-drawn, hand-lettered, and, of course, I was terrible at drawing. And then that obsession passed over to pop music, and again, I had no musical ability, so I invented a band on paper and in my head. They were called the Amoebas. The lead singer was called Ian Caput. I wrote their lyrics. I designed their album sleeves. I took them on tour at a top 10, which meant inventing 9 other bands and the personnel in those bands and what all their songs were called. And I was doing what all writers do. I was creating a world over which I could play God. And then from that, I got into short stories. And at high school, there was English, doing English at high school. There was always the chance to write a short story every week in your English class. And that was my favorite thing to do. And I was very good at it. I was always getting good marks at it. I remember one time the English teacher said, Ian, an interesting story. This is about a guy who thinks he's president of the United States, but he's actually in an insane asylum. And he said, why did you call it paradox? I went, well, it's just a great word. He said, do you know what it means? I went, no. It's the title of a song by Hawkwind. He went, well, go and find out what it means. And it bore no relation to the story whatsoever. But I just was in love with words. I was in love with words. So I was, you know, short stories were my, and my first success as a writer. I won second prize in a national short story competition. The following year, I won first prize. Then I had a story taken for newspapers, stories, short stories taken for the BBC Radio 4. That was how I started off as a writer, was doing short stories. But you can't make a living doing it.
No, you can't, but it's a great way.
Frustratingly, you can't make a living doing it. But I love it when people give me a challenge. So often they'll say, can you do us a Rebus story for the Christmas issue of our magazine? And that's lighter in tone than Rebus books, and you can be playful in it. And they'll say, can you put in a deep-fried Mars bar and a game of Cluedo? And I go, yeah, come on, more of that. I want these kind of challenges. So, you know, I enjoy the process. And with a short story, you know, give me a day or two and I can have it done. Whereas when you're starting to write a novel, it's an off-putting thing because it's going to take you months. It's going to be months of your life, minimum months of your life. Whereas with a short story, you get an idea, okay, I'll sit and write it, and you can sit in a cafe and have it done.
So as young Ian, he's doing his comic books, he's inventing bands. Did you have a mentor or a teacher who sort of steered you in the right direction?
No, I mean, I had a series of good English teachers. Mr. Gillespie was one I remember who would, he was young, he was vigorous, he liked Dylan, he liked Paul Simon, Neil Diamond. He would give us song lyrics as writing exercises. We'd go to the pub after school. Probably frowned on these days. I'd be 18, 17, 18 by then, but we'd go to the pub after school and talk about T.S. Eliot. He was a great guy. He's still around. Bless him, still around. And probably he steered me in the right direction because originally I was going to go to university. I was the first member of my family to go to uni, and I was going to be an accountant because I had an uncle who was an accountant. He was the only person in our family who owned his own house and owned a car. And I thought, well, I want some of that. And then I had an epiphany. I was no good at economics and good at English. And I said to my parents, look, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to be an accountant. I'm going to go to university and study English. And when I got to Edinburgh University, because I hadn't told many folk I was writing stories and poems and stuff, I thought I'd get beaten up by my peer group if I told them I was different, if I stood out from the crowd. I was very good at being a chameleon and looking like I fitted in. When I got to Edinburgh University, suddenly I was meeting people who wanted to be writers, musicians, actors, you name it, starting magazines, starting theatre groups, and I thought, these are my people, this is my tribe. And I nearly flunked second year because I was so busy. I was in a punk band, I was writing stories, I was writing poems, you know, too busy doing extracurricular activities. So I nearly got kicked out, but anyway, it all came good in the end.
Stuff. Pick another number, please.
4.
Okay, the Jack Harvey novels, The Witch Hunt, Bleeding Hearts, Blood Hunt. These aren't Rebus books. Mm. They're a bit different from usual stuff. Tell us about those.
Okay, well, the first Rebus novel was published in 87. I'd got married in 86, left university. Terrifying. We'd moved to London. We weren't making much money. My wife eventually said to me, look, if you want to be a full-time writer, we've got to get out of this place. We moved to rural France. We had still no money, but suddenly the only income we had was from my writing. I was writing one Rebus book. They were not fat books. They were fairly easy to write. So that left a lot of time. And no publisher wanted 2 Rebus books a year. They were having enough trouble selling one to audiences. So
that's changed, I can tell you.
I know that's changed, but honestly, back then, that's the way it was, you know? I mean, I was resolutely mid-list, selling a few thousand of each. Always on the verge of being kicked out. And so I decided I would write thrillers. So every year I wrote one Rebus novel and one thriller. And because I didn't want people to get tricked into buying them, I decided to use a pseudonym, Jack Harvey. And I wrote these big fat airport thrillers that were going to make my fortune. They didn't. But thriller market's a very different market. The market, the readers demand a lot of technical detail. So I know I was flailing because I was living in rural France in the era before the internet. So getting information on space shuttles, satellite technology, spies, hemophilia, my favorite one, Bleeding Hearts, is about a hemophiliac hitman. So he's a professional assassin, but he's got hemophilia, and somebody who's out to get him knows that's his fatal, apparently, you know, potentially fatal weakness. I spent months researching hemophilia for that book, and I only needed 2 sentences. But, you know, it was an enjoyable process, but as soon as I could stop doing it, I did.
Excellent.
Well, let me say one thing very quickly, just for people who are out there. I mean, you know, pseudonyms, it's an art in itself. If you look at bookshops and you look at the fire alarm's about to go off. The fire alarm's about to go off. It's a test. Don't worry. I'm going to tell this very quickly. So, if you look at the bookshelves, you'll find that the letter H is at eye level often, as is a letter R. If your surname is A or Y or Z, you're in trouble. You're at the very, very top or you're the very, very bottom. H is good. So I wanted books that were going to be at eye level. And Jack Harvey, Jack was my son's first name. And I thought maybe pissed Jack Higgins fans will buy them thinking of getting Jack Higgins.
Brilliant tip. Actually, we can hardly hear the fire alarm. I thought it would be much worse. This is the room not to be in if there's a fire, because you're doomed, basically. We're in the basement and... can't hear the fire alarm. We see a flashing light, I guess. We'll be all right. Cool. We'll carry on. Pick another number, please, sir.
Let's have number... Well, I don't know. This is intriguing because I thought it would be in order of the publication of the books, but it's not, is it? It is. I thought number 10 will be exit music. And okay, let's try number one. What's number one going to be?
Hide and Seek. Now, this was the second one. Well, we always ask about that difficult second book because, you know, you have Knots and Crosses was the first one. Brilliantly received. But, of course, you've then got to follow it up. And were you aware that you were writing a series at that point? How was Rebus fully formed? Tell us about this one.
Well, I don't know where you got that rumour that Knots and Crosses was well received. It really wasn't. I mean, it sold precious few copies and very few people reviewed it even. And having written Knots and Crosses with this cop called Rebus, I then thought, I'm going to be John le Carré, and I wrote a spy novel called Watchmen, which again didn't sell many copies. And I thought, well, I'll be a thriller writer. I wrote a thriller called Westwind that nobody wanted either. My editor at the time said, Ian, whatever happened to that guy Rebus? He was a really interesting character. And I thought, yeah, I liked him. He got under my skin. Maybe I'll do another one. And the first Rebus novel was meant to be an updating of Jekyll and Hyde, and nobody had got that. It was meant to be literary fiction, really. Nobody had got that he was meant to be a kind of Jekyll and Hyde character. So I thought Hyde and Seek. And Hyde and Seek, the book, involves a club called Hyde's, H-Y-D-E-S. So there's your nod back to Jekyll and Hyde. And again, it's the mean streets of Edinburgh. Rebus is still not a fully formed character. The first, I would say, three or four Rebus books, I was feeling my way towards who this guy was, getting to know him a bit. What makes him tick, you know, the inside of his head, his backstory, everything else. I think it's a much better book than Knots and Crosses. It's a more confident book. I'm not showing off as much. Knots and Crosses was a kind of show-offy book by a PhD student, you know, written by a guy literally who was doing his PhD at the same time he was writing the novel. This is a much leaner and meaner book, I think. And Rebus is an intriguing character. And I was starting to get the sense that if I wanted to write about contemporary Edinburgh, a crime series was a pretty good way to do it. So this was me sort of beginning to get the sense that maybe I was a crime writer, you know, because up until now I'd only written one actual crime novel. This was novel number two. This was kind of cementing me, I guess, in the crime fiction section in the bookshops, not the thriller section or the general fiction section. And I was okay with that by this stage because I'd started to read crime fiction, which I hadn't read before I wrote Knots and Crosses, the first Rebus book. And I liked it. I liked the sense of place. I liked the pacing. I liked the characterization. I liked the fact you can take on big themes, big moral questions in crime fiction. But it's a roller coaster ride as well. And so, yeah, by this stage, I was a bit more comfortable in my own skin and feeling my way towards being a bit more comfortable in Rebus's skin.
We had Mark Billingham on the show recently, and he's going back and he's rewriting his first Jack Thorne book. Well, not rewrite. And he's making a few sort of cosmetic changes because over the years eye colours change and stuff like that. Did you ever keep a file on Rebus on, you know, eye colour, hair colour, favourite records, that sort of thing? Or did it just evolve and would you go back and change anything?
I had this conversation with Mark as well because I saw him recently and he said he was doing that and he said, have you ever thought about it? And Ryan, my publisher, wanted new introductions for the books a few years ago, so I went back and read them for the first time since they've been published. And there's mistakes in them. There are people who change their rank in the police. Rebus is described sparingly. His hair colour is described once. His eye colour is described once. I couldn't tell you what it is. His musical taste hasn't really changed. I mean, he hasn't really bought a record since about 1975. He hasn't discovered any new artists since 1975. quite a few years ago now, somebody asked me a question at an event and about one of the early books, and I said, I'm sorry, I don't remember. I don't remember that scene in that book. And a guy came up and said, you need a database. And he did a database of all the characters in the Rebus books for me, just because he's a fan. And that was really useful to me, so I could work out how so-and-so, was so-and-so alive at the end of that book? Can I use them again? That kind of stuff. So some of Rebus's backstories in there, there's mistakes in the series. Would I go back and rewrite them? No. I've kept the mistakes in for people to find because I'm ashamed and I want to live with my shame until I die. I think my favourite horrible one was in Black and Blue, and I can see clearly now the song. I think I say it was Marvin Gaye. It wasn't. So I've kept that in to mortify myself.
Yeah. You talk about describing Rebus sparingly. Do you find that readers have a very clear image of who he is? Because, I mean, we'll talk. I mean, number two on this list is the Rebus TV show. And, of course, you know, you look at the cover of this is the collection of both, and you've got two very different actors there. You know, you've got Ken Stott and John Hannah, who are kind of chalk and cheese physically. Do people have a very clear idea of who Rebus is?
Yeah, some do. I mean, it's awkward, isn't it? I mean, I'm one of these people who, if I see a film or a TV show, then go and try and read the book, can't read it without seeing the actor. I mean, can you imagine trying to read The Godfather, you know, or The Exorcist without seeing the actors that are in them? They're kind of hardwired. We're hardwired to take in visual information. I would rather people read the books and have their own, ideas. And that's why I keep my descriptions of Rebus light, because I want readers to put their own faces and mannerisms in there and vocal tics and everything else. Having said all of that, just recently there's been a Rebus stage play, and Charlie Lawson, who's Big Jim McDonald in Coronation Street, who's Irish, has been playing Rebus. And I've seen it a couple of times now. He does a fine Scottish accent. His Scottish accent is okay. But physically, I think he's a pretty good match. John Hannah, probably a wee bit too young when he did it originally. Fans much happier with Ken Stott. On radio, there's another actor done it. Ron Donaghy's done it on radio. He's got a really good voice. Of course, when you've got the audiobooks, you've got another actor again doing it. So there are all these different Rebuses out there that exist at any time. And hopefully every reader's got their own sense of who he is. All I know is that he's, you know, because he's aged more or less in real time, he is, in the latest book, older than either Ken Stott or John Hannah, or indeed Charlie Lawson. And I am desperately trying to slow the clock on him a wee bit, but it's not easy if you want to keep the books realistic.
You mentioned the play there, which is Long Shadows, which you wrote with Rona Munro. Writing a play, very exercising a very different set of writing muscles there. I know it's not your first play. What lessons have you learned from writing theatre?
One of the big lessons I've learned is that I can't do it on my own. I need to have a proper playwright working with me. So the first one I did, Dark Entries. How was the first one called? Who knows? No, I can't remember. Dark something. Dark Road. Dark Entries was my comic book, my graphic novel. Dark Road was a play. Written with a playwright. This one, Long Shadows, Rebus, written with a playwright, Rona Munro. And I'll say, well, this is a cast of characters. And she'll say, I don't think so. Because in a novel, you can have 30 or 40 characters. In a play, not so much. In a novel, you can have as many chapters as you need, as many scene changes as you need. It can take place over as long a period of time as you like. Nope, not in the theatre. So she keeps me grounded. And Rona's very good on dialogue. So I kind of storyboarded it, and she went away and structured it a bit and did the dialogue and came back, and I polished the dialogue so it sounded like I thought Rebus would sound. And we just bounced stuff around. There were some problems along the way to do with red herrings and how can we get him to this point in his life, or how can we get him to this place in the city? What would he be doing here? But, you know, working together, two heads are better than one. We overcame them. And then the first night when I saw it in Birmingham, the previews, I just thought, yes, he's great. And the actor playing Cafferty especially, I thought, wow, you are pretty. That is pretty much how I imagine Cafferty would be. That nice mix of charm and menace.
Excellent stuff. We'll do one more of these. Pick one more number.
God, what am I going to pick now? Nine.
Okay, this is Black and Blue.
Hooray!
Which, you know, looking back, everyone at Orion says that was the breakthrough book. Tell us about
Nobody
that.
Nobody at Orion knew back then that was going to be the breakthrough. Let me tell you, you're too young to remember. No, this was the previous Rebus novels had been my apprenticeship. it came time to write Black and Blue, and I felt confident, but I felt confident I could go, I could push the envelope a bit, I could push myself a bit. I'd read a lot of James Ellroy, and I was very influenced by his writing style and structure, and also using real cases and real characters from history in his books. So Black and Blue had a very different voice, a very different narrative voice to it. It was just written in a different way. It was slangy, punk, you know, short, punchy sentences and paragraphs, short chapters, and it took in a much broader geographical sweep than previous books. So to me, it felt like a big book, and it also had a big, complex plot at the centre of it that involved around a real-life serial killer, a guy called Bible John, who was active in Scotland in the late 60s. Okay, all of that. So I gave it to my agent, and he goes, wow, this is a big leap. He presents it to my publisher, and I go, oh, it's Rebus again. And he said, no, honestly, look, this is a much, much, much bigger, better book. And they went, yeah, okay. Anyway, they, you know, no, I mean, I'm being a bit cheeky here. But no, what they did find that was important was they found a different look for the jacket. It suddenly didn't look just like a crime novel. It didn't look like Ruth Rendell or P.D. James, Reg Hill. It was moody. It was more like general fiction, atmospheric. They got a really bold typeface to use for the first time. So it didn't look like any other book on the market. And I think that was quite important. It stood out. And January, it was published January, and Marcel Berlin's reviewing it in the Times said, there won't be a better crime novel published this year. Mm. Come November, it won the Gold Dagger. And the paperback sold four times as many copies as my previous books. I still didn't make it into the top 10. It wasn't a top 10 bestseller in the UK or anywhere else, but it was a calling card. And the next book, because by then word of mouth had started. So people would go into bookshops and go, oh, Black and Blue, that was a great book. Has he written anything else? And people would go, yes, there's a backlist. So the backlist took off. That all got repackaged with the same look. So suddenly I had this great striking look in all the bookshops. And we had just were moving back from France. We lived in France, which meant I wasn't as available to do marketing and go into bookshops and go into libraries and talk to people and do interviews. And suddenly I was available again. So everything kind of clicked with that. It was the first time, and this was, you know, I mean, it wasn't Rebus novel number 4, 5, or 6, but it was about my 15th book in total. If you add in the Jack Harveys and everything else I'd done, 15 published books. And suddenly I was confident I am a full-time writer and I can make a go of this. I don't have to stop. I don't have to quit. I don't have to get a job. I'm going to make a go of it. So it was a really important book for lots and lots of reasons.
Were you aware when you were writing it that it was a step up?
Yeah, it felt like it to me. It felt like it. And you know what? It was lots of things behind it. I was thinking, Ian, you're a struggling mid-list author. This better be the breakthrough or you're done. So there was a lot riding on this book, and that really made me just much more determined to make it a bigger, better book. It was going to be more complex plot-wise. It was going to be just a big book. And it paid off. I mean, if it hadn't, God knows what would have happened. But it did pay off. And then that gave me the confidence to do other big books after it. And, you know, taking the crime novel, you know, taking my crime novels, I don't want to generalize too much, out of the kind of crime genre ghetto and saying, look, these are big, morally complex books about a big, complex character. They're not just for crime readers. It's not a string of poisoned pearls that the Duchess is wearing. It's not a game of billiards followed by a shooting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are big, complex novels about problems that are happening in society right now. And a lot of crime writers were coming along at the same time with a similar take on crime fiction. And I think that has been re-energizing for crime fiction in the UK.
Because all of your books, they're set essentially in the year they were released or the year before, whatever. So it'll have the politics, the music, the culture of the time. Was that always a deliberate choice?
Yeah, I mean, to use the real world as much as possible to get that suspension of disbelief so that readers go, oh, that really happened. Or, you know, I mean, have books set around the G8 when the G8 came to Scotland, the setting up of the Scottish Parliament, the 7/7 bomb attacks in London are all referenced in the books. Brexit is referenced in the latest book in a kind of just a passing thing about what it might mean for the criminal fraternity. Opportunity is the answer to that. The one thing I would say about that, though, I mean, for any writers listening, is if you set your books too much in the here and now, they can become dated very quickly. The early Rebus books have dated very quickly. I mean, I say to people, do you remember the G8? No. You know, they just don't. People don't remember the fact that G8 came to Scotland and there was big riots and protests outside the Gleneagles Hotel in Perthshire. because it just came and went. And, you know, the technology ages very quickly as well. The early Rebus books, fax machines are the big gods in the office, you know. Try telling that to the kids these days.
First part of the appeal, though, isn't it? It is a bit like stepping back in time, I guess.
Yeah, well, it is. But they do feel a bit dated, you know. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And all this stuff you've got to take on board if you're writing contemporary crime fiction. All CCTV plays a role. People's mobile phones can be tracked. You can be stalked via your mobile phone or your laptop computer or anything else. So all the technology that's available to the criminals and to the police, you've got to bear that in mind. And again, that technology changes very quickly. So what is current understanding of DNA analysis this year, 2 years from now, could be completely redundant.
We often ask writers for writing advice. They often give us great tips for writing. What's your worst habit? What's your bad habit when you're writing?
Eating too many Snickers bars. I don't smoke, and as a pause filler, I eat chocolate. And my wife thought, "Oh, this is Ian's spending too much money. I'll buy 5 packs because that'll save money." I was eating 5 a day. She discovered that I would eat all 5 in a day, and there'd just be wrappers around me. I didn't remember eating any of them; just wrappers. That's terrible. I don't have not many bad habits. I mean, every writer's different. I was asked by The Guardian years ago. A lot of writers were asked by The Guardian for your top 10 tips. And number 1 for me was get lucky, and number 10 was stay lucky. I mean, there's always an element of luck, and nobody really talks about it.
Yeah, that's very true. Really.
And also, when I recently was visiting professor of creative writing at the University of East Anglia, and when I did a one-on-one with these students, my main piece of advice that I gave to all of them was try not to treat it as an academic pursuit. Try to have a bit of fun the way you did when you were a kid in your bedroom writing poems or stories, you know, making up games, playing with toys, role-playing games, have fun adventures in your head. Try and recapture some of that, because that's who writers are. We're just kids who refuse to stop playing with our imaginary friends.
That's fantastic. Now, I can't leave Emma at Orion here. He said, you had to tell me your Sean Connery story. Can you reveal that? Is that with the lawyers on standby? Or?
Well, I'll tell you as long as we can do it in Michael Caine and Sean Connery voices afterwards.
Fire away.
All right. Well, many years ago, Sean Connery, who's a big fan of the Rebus novels, his people got in touch and said he was thinking of doing his autobiography, but he wanted someone to ghost it for him, and he'd asked if I would do it. So a meeting was organised for us in Edinburgh, and as the taxi turned up to take me, I thought, oh, I better take a DVD or something, get him to sign something. Look, the only thing I could find was League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Oh,
so, yes, quite. a film he wasn't terribly happy with.
A film that made him quit films.
Yes, quite. So I turned up at this house. He was staying at a friend's house, and he comes to the door, and come in, Ian, I've got some sandwiches for us, and have a cup of tea. And he said, you know, I'm a huge Rebus fan, and if only I'd been 20 years younger, I would have jumped at the chance to play John Rebus. And I thought, well, maybe 30 years younger, Sean. I then said, eventually I turned it down. I didn't turn it down to his face, but I did turn it down because he wasn't going to tell any of the really juicy anecdotes that I knew existed in his past. But I said, oh, by the way, can you sign this for me? The director was a fucking madman. He was a madman, absolute madman. I will never work again because of that film. Oh, my God. Wait, can you sign it anyway? So I may have the only signed copy of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen in existence.
Oh, my God. He did. He quit film after that, didn't he? He did one animated film, didn't he, for a charity.
Yeah, that was it. But after that, it was just onto the golf course. Said, Ian, if you do golf autobiography, you can come out to Markbeer and we'll just play some golf. I said, Sean, I don't play golf, mate. What? I don't have the golfing gene. Michael Caine, do you have the golfing gene?
No, I don't play. No, I prefer to roam the grounds and throw people off my land because it's bloody mine.
So you've never had a hole in one then?
Not since 1974.
Marvellous.
Ian Rankin, thank you very much. And have a very Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas, everybody. Keep buying books. Perfect Christmas gifts.
Absolute genius. That was probably one of the funniest moments in this podcast. That laugh. Unscripted Sean Connery and Michael Caine impression. I just, that had me laughing so much. How much fun was that?
It was so much fun. I should just explain it's about the fire alarm business as well. Every Friday afternoon at Hachette, they have a fire alarm, and we knew it was going to go off in the middle of the interview, and we were all ready to stop everything. But we were in the basement, and it doesn't really get heard there. So God help you if there's ever a fire and you're in the basement at Hachette. So anyway.
It sounded like somebody's, sounded like someone's phone going off in the other room.
Exactly. Yeah.
My gosh. What an amazing guy. I mean, so much fun. And I just feel so inspired having listened to that, listening to how, you know, his story started off, you know, mid-list, talks about selling only a few thousand copies, which I know for some people is a lot. But when you think about where he's at now, that's a tiny amount. And the fact that he was so on the cusp of his career ending right there.
Yeah.
And I always think, gosh, what would have happened had he have not done what he did, or what the decisions that they'd made that changed everything.
Yeah.
Isn't that, it just blows me away.
Yeah. The thing I've known, I've met Ian a few times. I've known about his career for a long time, but there were still tons of surprises in there. And the thing that jumped out at me was that actually he hadn't really read much crime fiction before he decided to make Rebus a serious character, which kind of blows me away. I always thought Ian was kind of dyed-in-the-wall crime author, but actually, of course, he studied, you know, English literature, and his background has always been in literature, and I think that's what Ian brought to the genre. I think he took that genre and injected that background into it. And, you know, we were going to talk about covers and cover art and stuff like that, but the cover style, particularly with his breakthrough book Black and Blue, the look changed. They changed the backlist, and it was fairly revolutionary at the time. It made crime look both literary and commercial, and of course it was ripped off by the rest of the industry not long afterwards. So it was a fascinating strategy that Orion took, just to make him stand out from the rest of the crowd, because crime covers back then, I don't even remember, a lot of them, it was just, you know, the big brand author name, usually in gold foil on the cover. It was usually quite gorgeous. And they took Ian's books and they made them look really, you know, literary and commercial at the same time. And that's the balance I think they've kept with his books ever since, is they do, you know, because his books, every single one of them is an absolute belter. They're so well written. They're well plotted, great characters, but just the prose as well. He's a really great prose stylist. And, and here he is, you know, 30 years later, you know, it's incredible career.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's actually inspired us, having listened to that. Mark and I have been having conversations, and this is a little preview actually to next week's episode and our New Year's Eve special, which is where we're going to talk about what our plans are for 2019 and the new goal that we are creating, another bestseller experiment, Crazy Car Crash in the making.
Yeah.
But as a little teaser to that, we are, we've been so inspired by listening to Ian, we are going to play around with the idea, and I think we can reveal this now, Mark, about potentially updating the cover of our book to see what difference it might make in the actual sales of the book. And we're actually going to do it through our sponsors, demonza.com, because we think, well, you know, we're out here talking about how brilliant they are. Well, let's use them and let's see what happens. So if you're in that process, if you've been inspired by Ian's story around how the changes, they went back and basically changed every single cover, didn't they, of all of the previous backlist and bought it up, and then people started buying it. And that's incredibly powerful. So if you have a series, and even if it's just one book, try changing the cover as an experiment. That's what this podcast is all about. And you can do that at demonza.com/bestseller XP. And you can type in the voucher code bestseller XP and get 10% off their packages. And we're going to be doing it and documenting it in the new year. So listen out for that.
I mean, Orion do that with Ian's books every few years. They give them a complete revamp. And it's interesting that the new one, In a House of Lies, is the first in a rollout of a new cover style for him. And it got him to number one, his best number one ever. And so, you know, the change has worked. It does make such a huge difference. You can't
underestimate it.
No, and you can't rest on your laurels either. You know, we had a cover of Back to Reality, which we really liked and it worked, but, you know, we have to roll the changes, I think.
Absolutely. And out of interest, I was looking at, I was in a bookstore the other day and looking at Harry Potter, and I'm sure that there's a new another set of new cover designs for Harry Potter. It's like the third or fourth different set of cover designs I've seen designed for the paperbacks.
Yeah.
And even on a book that successful, you think, why on earth? Why would they change the covers on a book that's so successful? Well, obviously it sells more copies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because you don't really see that in many other sort of media. I mean, movie posters kind of change a bit, but then you always remember the classic, like the classic Jaws poster, the classic Star Wars poster.
Yes.
But like with albums, like Dark Side of the Moon.
You never see it in music.
Has always been Dark Side of the Moon. They might do it for a special edition or 30-year anniversary or whatever, but they tend to stay the same. But books, I think, because there's so many of the bloody things, you're always struggling to stand out on that table or on that website or whatever, you know, wherever people are looking for your books. So, you know, and we can't all be Pink Floyd, unfortunately.
Absolutely. No, it's fantastic. So let's talk a bit about one of the things I really loved about what Ian said is, and this is great, top 10 Ian tip here, researching after the first draft.
Yeah.
Absolutely genius. Such a simple idea, but what a brilliant idea, because we know how much researching can take us down the rabbit hole. I mean, we did that for our novel. Do you remember? We were researching Glastonbury and we were researching ley lines and all kinds of things. We had a massive file. And I thought, what a brilliant idea. It's like, just write the little note, research this later in a section that you're writing and just keep on with the writing.
Absolutely. I'm writing something that's historical at the moment, set in the 1940s. And I've got my research. There's a pile of books down there which has got all my research about 1940s Britain and ration books and pub opening times. All these things are important, but I'm ignoring them. I'm ignoring that they're there, but I'm ignoring them until I actually need them, because I know once I go down that blooming rabbit hole, there's no coming out again, you know. So I'm just going to use the stuff that's important, because a story is not built around historical detail. That is something that, you know, if it's a crime novel, procedural detail. That's the thing that is like icing on the cake and it fascinates. But people read Rebus books because of the character of Rebus and his opposite, you know, his villain, his antagonist, Cafferty, you know, who is a just as fascinating a character, and the people that move with Rebus, you know, the people around him. And you don't read it because you think, oh, it's a good procedural. You read them because of the character. That's why people keep coming back again and again and again. And I think that's the thing you need to focus on initially, and then you do your research so that it has that little stamp of authenticity.
It's the authenticity that's crucial, and it's almost like, for some reason, I think of it a bit like, you know, having been to a Christmas panto in the last week. It's the backdrop, isn't it? It's you know, a play would be rubbish if you had great actors on stage, but the backdrop just was really bad. So you've got to have that, but it still is the backdrop. It should never be at the forefront of what you're writing about, because it then just detracts you. But it was interesting for him to that it sounded like it was a process that Ian obviously learned over time, and I think you know, there's probably a lot of people out there that maybe listening to this thinking, yeah, I'm completely and utterly in the mire of research. And if you are, tweet and release is what I say. Tweet about it. Tell us this is going to be our new thing for 2019. Your declaration, your public declaration, and your tweet and release. It's like, let go of all the stuff that's holding you back, because you have to recognize it before you can actually change it. So that's an important thing. I think another thing that I loved, which actually I really resonate with Ian, because it was similar to me growing up, is that he talked about how he started life out kind of reading comics and talked about the Beano. And that's exactly, we've talked about this like years ago, he says with his long white beard on this podcast. But I grew up reading comics. That was where I learned to my love of story and learned how to read. And it's great to know that there are million selling authors out there that followed that path as well. You can't deny it. They're brilliant. They're brilliant ton of learning tools. And
the thing he said towards the end, which is, you know, just act like when you were a kid, you know, do that play acting, you know, write like you're a kid.
It.
You know, that. I mean, his advice was get lucky and stay lucky, which is quite funny because, you know, we have no control over that. But, you know, have fun with it. You know, write as it's like dance if like no one's looking. I think write as if you're still writing, you know, when you're a kid. And I think that's such an important lesson. Particularly if you do get signed up with a publisher and you've got a deadline to meet, or if you've set yourself a big declaration to self-publish 3 books in a year or whatever, you know, that adds pressure, that adds expectation. And sometimes you think, if there's expectation out there, then I've got to deliver to make these people happy. Well, you know, there's writing for a market, but you've also got to write to please yourself. And I think, you know, if you can do that first and then market it, you'll be a much happier and healthier writer.
Yeah, I it's funny actually that my wife used to always use the saying of we should all be more childlike. It's not about being childish. It's about being childlike. And I often coach with people and we talk about, especially when you're talking about dreams and you have to kind of fall into this idea of visualizing something and fantasizing about something that you want in life, which seems almost untouchable. You have to get back into that childlike state that we all still have. We all have this inner child within us, I think. I mean, I still feel like a kid. I mean, what was our funniest criticism about our childish ways on this podcast? Yes.
childish waffle, wasn't it? Yeah.
Childish waffle, right? So ultimately we all do still have this inner child. And if we can unleash that, if we can actually tap into that, then that's where the real fantasy of our lives is. And not just from a perspective of, I wish I could become a million selling author, but in your books as well. It's like, go and have the kind of fun that we had when we were like, it was summer holidays, 1978, you know, and we had our friends around in the garden, and suddenly our garden became this fantasy land. And I see my kids playing sometimes still, and it reminds me every day that it's the most beautifully creative thing. And we do get terribly serious when we become adults. We get terribly bogged down with mortgages and this idea that we have to make a living. And we forget that we should be having a living, that we should be being human rather than doing human, which is the thing that we're always focusing on. So that I think is one of my kind of focuses for 2019, is to kind of reignite that childlike persona that we all have within us. And it's great to hear Ian reminding us of that, because it's obviously been a big part of what he does. And I'm sure it's a great way of relieving the pressure that he has. As I mean, I can't imagine what it must be like to have to deliver like his eighth, how many that is, you know, book, and still try and make it as good or better than what he's previously done. Maybe that's one of his secrets.
It made me think of, there's a very good Jerry Seinfeld documentary called Comedian, which I think is on Netflix at the moment, where having made his billions, Jerry Seinfeld goes back out on the road just doing stand-up comedy in small clubs. And he has, you know, 5 minutes of material, 10 minutes of material. It's a fascinating documentary. And what he says in that is that when he was at school, and this will resonate with you because you and I had all the same mates. You know, he said that when he was at school, all of his friends were as funny as he was, all of them. They were all funny guys. And I think back to our friends and mutual friends at school, and they were all hilarious, really, really funny people. Totally. Yeah. Crack me up constantly. But as you get older, you get that beaten out of you. You know, you go to a serious meeting and you have to sit there and you can't wisecrack all the time because it'd be supremely annoying, as I've learned. And you know, so you get that beaten out of you and you become serious again and you lose that sense of wonder, you know, that childlike sense of wonder. I think that's a big lesson to learn, big lesson to learn.
Definitely, definitely. And on a par with that, one of the things that Ian mentioned, which I found fascinating, especially as a coach, is this idea that he had this moment, didn't he, in his career where he pretty much said, this is it. If I don't pull this one out of the bag, if I do not write the very best novel that I can write, it's game over. Yeah. And it's almost like that was his kind of declaration to himself in some ways, but there was the pressure as well of having to make it happen, which is also another interesting thing. I sometimes wonder when people are kind of writing in their spare time and they've got a day job. I mean, not, you know, I mean, I guess you've kind of been there, Mark, but in some ways you're now kind of crossing the threshold, as it were, on the hero's journey. You know, naked and wondering where the sword is and all the rest of it. But in terms of actually having this sense of pressure to make it work, he actually, I could hear it in his voice. He was saying, I mentally had to step it up. Yeah. He had to step it up. And as a result of stepping it up, it happened.
Yeah.
And I do think, and that weirdly enough, that's the exact experience I had in music. It's like there was a moment where I thought to myself, am I going to pretend for the rest of my life that I'm substandard, I can't do this, that I'm not as good as all the other people out there that you could admire and you think one day, if only. You have to actually internally say, this is it. I am good enough. I'm going to step it up. I'm going to see just what I can squeeze out, because there's so much more that we don't realize we have in terms of our potential. And to hear him say, to hear Ian say that was fascinating, because it is one of those moments in your life. And, you know, did you, I mean, have you ever had that moment yourself, Mark? Was there a moment where you were writing a screenplay and you thought...
Oh, it's Robot Overlords. Yeah, Robot Overlords.
Was
question,
it? So
yeah.
That was your moment as well?
Yeah, yeah,
which
yeah.
is, again, an interesting, because that happened, right?
Yeah.
In the movie.
Well, yeah, and it was while we were writing it, I think it was Universal, were interested in picking it up. I know John had a meeting, and I remember John came to me and said, look, this is... I'm just going to give you a heads up on this, because if Universal pick this up, they'll probably fire both of us as writers and get someone, because that would have made it. I mean, what we shot was about £9 million. It would have tripled the budget, and they'd have got. It's just what they do in screenplays. They get other people in that they trust and know and have a track record. And from then, that kind of got my back up a bit. I thought, well, bloody hell, this is going to be the best script I've ever written, you know. And it does,
right.
You know, you do have to step up to the plate. And other moments, like when we started auditioning actors and you hear actors saying the words, and when you're rehearsing with the kids, you know, it's a nonstop bombardment of this has to be good, because it's not just you anymore. It's other people out there. But just going back to Ian, I think the thing that I admire about him as well is that he has not rested on his laurels. The temptation, and you do see this with commercial fiction, is if an author writes a certain kind of book that propels them into the big time, then they just write that book again and again and again. And having read a number of Ian's books, I've not read all of them, but I've read a number of them, and I can tell you, he does not rest on his laurels. He challenges himself with every book. He doesn't write the same book again and again. Each one is different to the other. I mean, they all focus around Rebus, but he is that blank canvas, if you like, where, like he says, you know, a book set in the 90s will have been set in the 90s, and it's a reflection of society. And the books he writes, you know, are very honest and are sort of set in that time. And reading Ian's work, you've seen Scotland and our society evolve along with it. And it's absolutely fascinating. I think in 100 years' time, they could be looking back at Ian's works and saying, you know, this is how it was at the time. And I think, you know, that's a great legacy to have.
Absolutely, yeah. It becomes a historical novel in itself.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
of how it ages ultimately. So it's really interesting. I also loved as well, there's so much stuff. I mean, we could do a 3-hour episode on this, so we'll have to do some special. So look out for that, folks, down the road. But leaving in his mistakes, I thought, what a brilliant thing to, you know, because nothing's ever perfect. And I know that some people really fret over that and they beat themselves up. You know, they'll I remember Chris Martyr from Coldplay saying that, you know, there's one track on his album, they rushed it out because EMI were pushing them for a deadline. And that one track, because I know you're a big fan of Coldplay, Mark, but that one track on...
oh, sorry. Well,
I love Coldplay. one track on their album he really didn't like, and it kind of basically ruined the whole album. And that's, I mean, an analogy of that in a writing world is you might have like a horrendous mistake in your novel, which just like, oh my gosh, you know, I mean... you know, getting a song wrong, I don't think is a major mistake.
Well, the weird thing is, if you go back, I listened back to that in, you know, preparing for this recording, and I could hear myself hesitating, which is a weird thing to say, but I'm sitting there thinking, I can see clearly now that's Johnny Nash, but I had the name Johnny Cash. I could not get the name Johnny Cash out of my head, and I knew it was wrong, and I was going to jump in, you know, because if you're like me, if you're like a music nerd, and you would go, oh yeah, of course that was Johnny Nash, I can see clearly now, yeah, of course it was, yeah. And I wanted to jump in and just have that moment, and I had the name Johnny Cash at the front of my head, and I could not get it out, and I had to Google it afterwards. It's tragic. So it's not just Ian, it was me as well. Total blind
spot. Everyone. I mean, you can research to the cows come home, which literally happens in our novel, but you ultimately have to accept that every piece of work is flawed in some way. And I think it's lovely that, you know, it's embrace our imperfections. In fact, one of the things I coach on, people talk about being perfectionists. I said, look, we shouldn't be perfectionists. We should strive to be nearly perfect. Let's just be nearly perfect. That's as good as we can get. Because if you're a perfectionist, you'll never release anything. You'll never think it's not quite good enough. And that becomes a paralysis. So nearly perfectionism for 2019, folks. That's my advice. But there's so much more we could go on. But I know that we've got to dive into some social media, Mark. I know there's a lot happening in the world of writing. And it is a difficult time, isn't it? Christmas time, there's a lot going on in December.
Yeah.
That's why I think they made NaNoWriMo in November. so that people, because if they did it in December, it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Because everyone's so busy with other things. But what's happening on the old social media front?
We had a really nice message from McLab Pub on Twitter, who is, he also writes as Tom Cooney, author of The Unwitchy Witch, but his real name is Ian. And he sent us a message. He said, "Hello, Marques and Mark D. I'm on catch up still and just listened to episode 141. Feel like I've been on the listener journey with Mark D's story. I think the nonfiction book idea is a great idea. I've been entirely inspired by the podcast, and something about how you've invited listeners into your lives as people in all this leaves me completely moved by the journey and story. My day job overlaps into the nonfiction, emotional, spiritual stuff as a psychotherapist and psychiatrist, so hugely interested. Hope you both have as good a Christmas as it can be. Best wishes, Ian." Thank you, Ian. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ian. And yeah, next week, actually, if you tune into our special, we'll be talking about what our goals and plans are, not just obviously with our co-creations that we're doing on the podcast and the book, but also personal goals as well in the writing world. So I'll be talking a bit more about my nonfiction goals for next year. So we are going to be doing more nonfiction stuff as well. So it's great to hear the feedback from people who are excited about that.
Fantastic. And another one of our listeners has a book out, which is fantastic news. We had an email from Andrew Davenport. He said, "I keep forgetting to do this, but my book, No Way Home, is coming out on Sunday." This is a couple of Sundays ago, so it's out now. "I'm not saying this for a shout out or because I'm asking you to review it, but because I want to send you both a copy to say thanks so much for all your help in motivating me to keep going and get the damn thing finished. My first full-length novel, Escape, is also moving along a treat, and I'm nearly done with getting that already." So yeah, you can find No Way Home on Amazon. And yeah, it's a collection of short stories, which looks fantastic. So do check that out. And Andrew, thank you so much for letting us know about that. And do please keep us posted on all your future projects. It's fantastic. What really tickled me this week was Lily. It's Lily M. Wright's on Twitter. Discovered in The New Statesman, written by a journalist called Harry Harris, a social history of the Colin the Caterpillar cake. Right. Now, here's Here's the thing. When do you think Colin the Caterpillar was launched?
Colin the Caterpillar. So for those new to the podcast, Colin the Caterpillar is a classic cake, birthday cake that kids have from Marks and Spencer's in the UK. And I don't know if it predates me, because I
know. It's not that old. It's not that old. But of course, we featured it in Back to Reality. Our protagonist gets Colin the Caterpillar cake for her birthday. I was astonished to realise it's been with us since 1990.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's older than the internet.
Exactly.
My goodness me.
And it's an absolutely...
That's crazy.
I'll put a link in the show notes. It's in the New Statesman. It's just incredible. The people who've had Colin the Caterpillar cakes, all the spin-offs, all the rip-offs as well. So it's, it's really, really interesting. Nice bit of cake social history there.
I can't believe it was in the New Statesman. That's like real highbrow kind of stuff.
Exactly. But, you know, it's become part of our culture over here.
Culture, yeah, along with red phone boxes and double-decker buses.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent.
We had a lovely tweet from Eric Betton, who is at Eric, that's E-R-I-K, Betton, on Twitter. He said, "The AITC doctrine of Catherine Ryan Howard really paid off today." Now, listeners who heard our wonderful interview with Catherine Ryan Howard, Arse in the Chair is AITC. That was her big tip for actually getting something finished. And Eric says, "After 10 agonizing minutes of staring at a blank screen, the words started coming, and plenty of them. Thanks, hashtag deadline stress." Catherine did reply to him and said, "Hooray, sitting down at the desk is the hardest bit." And it so often is, isn't it?
Yeah, we know. They say the way to give up smoking. You know the way to give up smoking, Mark?
No, do tell.
Don't put a cigarette in your mouth.
Right.
The way to start writing? AITC.
Yeah, put your ass
in the chair.
Put your ass in the chair, yeah.
That's what it's all about.
We have a public declaration deadline that's been beaten. This is Sam J. Wright, who is at Sam J. Wright number one.
She tweets, I'm currently in complete shock and awe. Yesterday, I finished my first draft 4 days ahead of schedule and I was so surprised I doubted that it was done. But no, it's done. It exists. And I owe a tearful thank you for the marks as I've never gotten this far before. And she's put a little gif of Rocky at the top of those steps in Philadelphia. Wow. So, yeah, fantastic, Sam. Congratulations. Great stuff.
Congratulations.
Finishing it is half the battle, isn't it? Just getting to the bloody end.
I know. But you know what? The amount of people that do public declarations that are finishing early, I think there's more people finishing their books earlier because of the public declaration than finishing it on time.
Yeah, no question.
Or even not meeting. I mean, there's something in this. There's definitely something in this.
Yeah, no question.
I love it.
No
well question. Done, Sam. Yeah, congratulations great stuff, to Sam. You.
And also, now, you've seen Robot Overlords, haven't you? You've seen
I have, yes.
The young hero of the piece, the actor Callan McAuliffe, who is at this very moment, he's in the latest series of The Walking Dead as well. So he's gone to really, really great things. Well, Callan, when we started out on this podcast, I did speak to Callan and we did do interviews with Callan because he had started writing a book, but we never aired them because we kind of said to Callan, you know what, we should probably wait till you finish it and blah, blah, blah. And he's only gone and done it. He's got a book called The Hill Ghost, which looks absolutely beautiful. And he said there are limited physical copies, all of which are signed, and you can get them from Amazon.com. I've ordered my copy. It's coming from the States. It's only available in Amazon US. Because they're signed copies, they can only keep them in one warehouse, I guess. So I'm waiting for my copy to arrive, but I'm really, really looking forward to reading that. So huge congratulations to Callan, because I think he still listens to the show as well. He certainly was listening to it when we started out. And
in between dodging zombies.
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing.
That's
super. Fantastic.
Really, really.
Well, congratulations, Callan, and we will get you on the show. You know that, obviously.
One way or another.
That's brilliant. Fantastic stuff.
And what I'd just like to say as well, I haven't checked Back to Reality for reviews for quite a while, actually. And just today, just apropos of nothing, thinking, I better have a look and see what our reviews are like. And certainly in the US, we've had a couple of really nice reviews just quite recently. So Kindle customer, who is anonymous, such a fun read. Love how it's put together and all the silliness. Nice to read something in this genre without a lot of gratuitous violence. Hope to read more by these authors. Now, just to warn you, Kindle customer, if you read my book, The End of Magic, there's lots of gratuitous violence.
So could Back to Reality be a nice, easy warm-up then towards that?
Yeah, no. Just,
ease you in gently.
Just avoid The End of Magic if you don't like gratuitous violence. And we had a lovely review from Michelle Vess as well on Amazon.com. Sometimes we wish we could have a second chance at life. Back to Reality is a great what if to lose yourself in. This book was funny and fast-paced right from the start with a cast of quirky characters and tons of music references. The Two Marks did an awesome job capturing the essence and tension of mother-daughter relationships, commercial success versus contentment, letting go of the past and realizing life is short and it's never too late to live your dreams. So fantastic. Thank you so much, Michelle. We really, really appreciate it.
Beautiful review, Michelle. That's almost good enough to have as a blurb on the back of the book, isn't it? I was going to say, that's nicely done and written for us. Okay, I'm going to put it out there. It's Christmas time. You're sitting listening to this maybe by the fire. You're maybe thinking, maybe it's even Christmas Day listening to this. Treat yourself, pop over to Amazon dot wherever you are and buy yourself Back to Reality if you haven't read it. It is actually, it's a perfect book to read over the Christmas holidays, isn't it, Mark? As well as the summer holidays, but it's that kind of fun, relaxing, and 50x million five-star reviews can't go wrong. And we haven't paid for any of those.
No, we haven't.
We haven't paid for one of those reviews. I mean, it's just people love this book. And to give us a little spike as we move into our New Year's Eve special, maybe you would like to go out and buy yourself that present for a mere $2.99 or whatever it's currently retailing.
Or what you can do, and this has been in the States for a while, but it's just launched in the UK. If you look below the buy button, there's a button that says give as a gift. So you can give a Kindle as a gift.
Oh,
so this has finally launched.
Finally.
It launched very quietly a couple of weeks ago. Amazon Kindle launched it very quietly. And
give a book as a gift or give a Kindle as a gift?
Give a Kindle as a gift. So if you've enjoyed Back to Reality, you want to recommend it to a friend, just click on give as a gift and then you put your friend's email address in. They'll get a link. They can download to their Kindle. to their phone, to their, you know, they don't even have to have a Kindle device. They just need an Amazon account and they can download it onto the app or whatever they want.
Because you can download, people think you actually need to buy a Kindle to read our book. You don't. You can read it on your phone with the Kindle app or your iPad with the Kindle app. That's great. So that's actually something we should start experimenting with, shouldn't we, Mark?
Yeah.
Because if everyone who bought the book, who liked it, gifts it to 50,000 of their friends, that could be quite good for sales.
Well, the other thing is, I know a lot of indie authors have been using this in the States for giveaways or for...
If you're drunk on sherry right now, why not do like... You know, there's that show we've got, Send to All. Mike McIntyre, he gets someone's phone, like Jamie Oliver, and he basically writes a really funny message and sends it to every single one of his contacts. And in his case, it was asking his wife to pick up a McDonald's for him on her way home, which, if you know Jamie Oliver, is very unlike him. And then it got sent to every single one of his contacts. and we could maybe do gift to all. How about that?
Yeah.
Where you buy it for every single person in your contacts. That'd be...
Do
you know what? And as I say that, a rainbow has just appeared in front of... I'm not kidding.
Wow.
There was a rainbow.
Are you on a ley line?
I probably am, actually. Vancouver Island is very much a ley line-tastic.
Yeah, I bet. Excellent.
I've done my research. There's lots of interesting stuff that goes on this island. Absolutely. But yeah, so Mark, is there anything else we want to remind the listeners of in terms of getting in contact with us?
Well,
how to get through social media?
Well, I get in touch with us. We're at bestsellerexperiment.com. We're on Facebook as Bestseller Experiment. Twitter and Instagram is at BestsellerXP. And also message us through Patreon if you're a Patreon supporter. And we had a message from one of our new Patreon supporters, Stephanie she sent me a phonetic pronunciation of her name as well. I'm going to do this again. Stephanie Indikevich. Indikevich.
Nice.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Beautiful name.
She says, the podcast is in my ear every day at work. I've been binge listening since August of this year and finally almost caught up. I've yet to write anything more than a couple of rough first chapters that ended up stuffed in a box and hidden, but the podcast has inspired me to try it again. So, Stephanie, thank you so much for your support on Patreon. We could not do this show without you. Thank you so much for letting us know. We want to know that you get to the end of a book. We want you to finish your first draft. We want you to, just smash it out of the park. So make 2019 the year that happens. And a big thank you also to our new Patreon followers, Eileen Kerrigan and Ollie. Just Ollie, thank you both for your support. To all our Patreon supporters, we've got some very exciting stuff coming for you next year.
Brilliant stuff. And I am very excited. And if you have goals for 2019, if you have a public declaration you wish to make, if you want to tweet and let go, is that what I called it? No, tweet and release.
Forget.
Tweet and release. Thank you. Tweet and release. then drop us a note, because as you probably heard, we read stuff out on this show and we'd love to give you further encouragement. So do join us next week. We've got a very special Two Marks New Year's Eve. We haven't done a Two Marks episode in quite a long time, and we are very excited about this because obviously there's big changes happening in Mark's life. There's big changes obviously have happened in my life this year, and we're going to share with you what our goals are for next year, and we want you to think about what your goals are for next year, because goals are not just for New Year's Eve, they are for the whole year. So if you've got a few quiet moments in between your sherry and your Christmas specials and your stuffing, have a think about what it is you want to actually attempt. And before we dive off, we are going to announce an incredible competition for you all. As it's Christmas and it is a season of giving, we have the most beautiful collection of Ian Rankin books. Mark, tell us what you've got in front of you there.
Oh, they're gorgeous. They're all first editions. They're all hardcovers. I've got signed first editions of Ian Rankin's Even Dogs in the Wild, Rather Be the Devil, and his new book, In a House of Lies. All first editions, all hardcovers, all signed by Ian. Just a fantastic. If you've never read him before, you can dive in with any book. If you're a collector, these are perfect. It's just a wonderful, wonderful prize. And they can be yours, dear listener. How do they do it, Mr. D?
Well, it's very simple, Mr. Stone. Thank you for asking. They pop along to the bestsellerexperiment.com website, where you'll find actually our entire backlist of all the interviews that we've done, plus a load of other goodies. And on the main navigation bar, you will simply see the navigation competitions. And on there, you'll drop down and see Ian Rankin. Click on that, pop your email address in, and you are entered. But If you'd like to get more entries, there's a little trick. If you share the competition with friends, family, and your pets, they can all enter too. And the more entries you generate, the more entries you get. So if you want to shout at one of those three books, then go and tell your friends about the competition as well, and you will increase your chances of winning. So that's bestsellerexperiment.com, and we will see you there. And this competition ends at the end of January. So don't wait, go do it now.
I'll put a link in the show notes as well to make that easier to find for you too. And of course, if you're a Patreon supporter, you automatically get entered into
already
these contests.
Entered.
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing?
It is fantastic.
Excellent. And if you'd like to just join Patreon instead of entering the competition, then you simply go to patreon.com/bestseller experiment. And you've got three different tiers, which are tithing your well-earned income to keep this show going, to keep Mark in Hobnobs, and to ensure that we can keep bringing you incredible interviews like we have today. So please do come and join us at Patreon. Give yourself that gift as well, which quite a few people have done, which I absolutely love, the fact that people have given themselves Christmas and birthday gifts by giving themselves a whole year's worth of extras. I won't tell you everything there is. You get loads of extra goodies and bonuses, but please do come and support this show, patreon.com/bestseller experiment. So, Mr. Say, that just leaves me to wish you a very happy, merry and wonderful Christmas with your lovely family. And I hope you have a fantastic time on Christmas Day with all of your extended lovelies as well.
And to you and yours, mate, have a good one. It's a wonderful time of the year, but I know it can be a difficult time of the year for people as well. But just, you know, reflect on your year, have a wonderful time. And it's a great time for reflection and a great time to, you know, tell someone you love them. It's, you know, it's don't leave it, you know. I'm getting all very soppy. Anyway, happy Christmas, everyone.
Happy Christmas to you. So it's a goodbye from Mark 1.
And a goodbye from Mark 2. Ho,
ho, ho, ho, ho. Ho, ho, ho. Goodbye, everyone. It's a very special time of year.
It is. It is indeed. Time of year.